You are listening to Shakespeare Decoded, a podcast series by Shakespeare Dallas. Class division, racism, sexuality, intolerance, financial crisis, misogyny, politics, crime, war, death, disease. These are the burning issues in today's dysfunctional global society. They were also the burning social issues of Shakespeare's day. Shakespeare's characters experience practically every human emotion you can think of. They experience the full human condition, something that never changes from century to century or country to country, despite all our differences in knowledge, culture, and emphasis. This podcast series explores the social issues, connecting them straight from the page to our modern world. Each episode features a different host and a unique set of panelists.
Hello and welcome to the Shakespeare Decoded podcast. Brian Wilson in Dallas, Texas, and I'm with Stefan Wolfert, founder of Decrute. Stefan, thanks so much for joining the pod.
Thanks for having me on, truly.
Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about Macbeth, a little bit about Decrute, a little bit about my podcast, Combat and Classics. But I'd love to get started, Stefan, with just a little bit of why you started Decrute and what you do with that organization.
I got out in 93. I got out of the Army in 93. And I was struggling. And I thought, because I wasn't a Vietnam veteran, post-Vietnam veteran, I thought, oh, I can't have PTSD. I can't have this, can't have that, right? I don't deserve it. And there was shame associated with getting out, so I didn't tell many people. But I was struggling. I was having a really awful time transitioning out of the military back into civilian life. And part of my transition was because I saw Shakespeare's Richard III. And when I saw Shakespeare's Richard III, it not only helped me understand, because Richard III is a veteran talking about, hey, I was great at the military, I was great at war, now it's over, who am I, what do I do? I so identified with it that it literally left the Army and went to graduate school for acting. While I was working on the classical actor training as well as the text, I found that what I now would call my symptoms were severely diminished. And in fact, not only just when I was either in rehearsal or on stage, but I found that I could begin transferring the skills that were helping me cope during a play, during a rehearsal process. I was using those off stage as well. And that's when it got me thinking about how we're recruited. We have all these resources that help us when we're being recruited into the military. And we have all these access to all these resources in the military. But when we get out, we don't have a decruiter. We're not helped to be decruited. So that's where I took the name from. And I was patient zero, trying to use classical actor training to help mitigate my PTSD, my ADHD, my alcoholism, all of this. And when I met my wife, Dawn Stern, she's not a veteran, but she was finding the exact same thing. We were having the same conversation. And she was describing how it was helping her deal with the PTSD from, her torture as a child, growing up as a black woman in a small town in the Midwest, and then being an adult woman in the U.S. That was the foundings of Decrute. I was really patient zero, and the more I worked, the more other veterans were coming to me, because I was doing full plays with veterans at that time, and they were finding, hey, this helps me as well. And we decided to refine it down to a specific deliverable program that's also transferable.
The idea of developing skills, both in acting and in coping with PTSD, is very interesting to me. Can you give us an idea of what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is the third part of that would be the military's training, right? Because the military uses community, rhythm, and breath to help wire us for war. Those are three of the main, in my opinion, three main pillars on which so much of the training is built. And community, rhythm, and breath are the same thing in putting on a play. They're the same thing in dancing. They're the same thing in music. Any communal or collaborative art process, in particular theater, I think, because we're using our voice and breathing together. But coming together and having a space where we can try something where it feels like life or death, but isn't. The Department of Defense in Harvard did a study that found that we veterans have much higher ACE scores, adverse childhood experiences. Right? So we are higher on the scales of coming from, you know, families with alcoholism, drug addiction, depression, abuse, et cetera, et cetera. We don't all have to be tied up in a closet and tortured, although that's true as well. But it just so happens that whether it's neglect or, you know, accidental or intentional, that we tend to end up in the military, or that's one of the places where we go. So now the military is taking people who've survived childhood, adverse childhood experiences, and how do they get us to work together towards something that we are generally as a human being not wired to do, and that is to kill. And everyone has to do it no matter what their job is, right? Everyone has to be prepared to do that. And the three pillars on which that is built is community, or camaraderie, we call it in the military, rhythm and breath. Think about it. When we march, it's in a rhythm. We breathe together. We sing together. When we were trained to fire the weapon, we're taught to breathe in, exhale, hold your breath, squeeze the trigger in between your heartbeats, continue breathing, find the next target. So they use the breath in our own natural body's rhythm to wire us for war. So why not use that same thing to unwire us from war? And it turns out that Shakespeare gave us a template by which to do that, because Shakespeare wrote in a verse pattern, what we call iambic pentameter, which usually by this point when I say that name, we begin to get, you know, soft focus in the eyes.
I'm tracking.
Good. I just mean because most people, Shakespeare, it's inflicted on us in high school, right? But Shakespeare wrote in a verse rhythm, iambic pentameter, the heartbeat. And remember in the old days when we learned CPR, it was five chest compressions to one breath. Shakespeare wrote in the same rhythm, ba-dump, 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 ba-dump. And it gives us a template on how to breathe and yet share experiences that we've gone through in a rhythm that allows us to stay in regulation. So much so that a researcher and a clinician by the name of Strozier, S-T-R-O-Z-I-E-R, was working with trigger warning or activation warning. I'm going to mention 9/11, but not describe it. He was working with survivors of 9/11. And what he found was that when people were describing traumatic experiences, in this case 9/11, who have not yet processed that trauma, who've not yet integrated it, tended to speak in verse, and specifically, very often, iambic pentameter. So they take a breath and speak roughly five stressed syllables. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. Take a breath and ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. So it turns out Shakespeare's already writing in the rhythm for English speakers of who've survived trauma. In trying to describe it, he's already written it in a rhythm of unprocessed trauma. So we take that, along with prompted writings and classical actor training, which very often we're standing in a circle. I actually borrowed the circle from Native American theater companies that I've worked with, Native Voices and Native Earth, Yvette Nolan specifically, where they called it a medicine circle, where we're all equidistant from the middle, no one's higher, no one's lower, we're all equal, and now we can share within that space, and we're creating a container within which to share. And what we'll often do is when someone's sharing, we'll turn it over into, from our own language, into Shakespeare's monologues. I've taken 22, specifically for 22 veterans killing themselves every day, and edited them down to the military veteran experience specific to ours, cultivated over the last 20 years or so, where the monologues then become the language for the veteran. So not only the iambic pentameter to breathe, just like we're marching or just like we're firing the weapon, whatever military training we have, but you're using this guy's poetry to offer us language that we may lack for ourselves to describe our own experience.
You know, I think that my experience of joining the Marine Corps in 2000 and wanting, for some reason, feeling that going to combat was the thing that I needed to do as a man, right? You know, and what drew me to the Marine Corps is the high likelihood of that, because, you know, I was in high school. I was, you know, a Cold War kid. You know, we're pretty close to the same age. And, you know, I went to high school in the 90s. And so, you know, went to the Naval Academy in 96 and wanted to go to the Marine Corps and was, you know, fingers crossed I get to go to like Kosovo or something like that, because the Cold War, you know, has ended. And then, like you said, you know, trigger warning, 9/11, 9/11 happens. And then all of a sudden the world has changed. that combat is something completely different, something completely different than what you would expect. Going to war is something completely different than you'd expect. And that no matter how much the recruiter and how much the people that trained you prepare for it, you're not ready for it in every way possible, and certainly emotionally. And that's why, you know, I wanted to touch on Macbeth a little bit, because, you know, you mentioned Richard III, seeing Richard III. I'm actually producing Richard III right now. We're opening in less than a month. So we're working on that for the company that I run, Shakespeare Everywhere. I work with Shakespeare Everywhere. And Macbeth was kind of one of the plays that hit me as, how does Shakespeare know all this stuff?
Yeah.
There's a couple things. Just the highlights for me is something like the idea of the feast and the feast of death and the feast of revelry.
Mm.
The opening scene is the three sisters feasting on the dead bodies, is mostly how it's interpreted. There's room in the language, but it's a feast of the dead. And then you have Duncan's feast, where he is, you know, celebrating Macbeth. And then you have Macbeth's feast, where he sees the ghost of Banquo. And so there's something in this feasting and death. And then there's also this idea of, there's no sex in Macbeth, you know, and Lady Macbeth yeah. specifically says, you know, is kind of calling on the gods to unsex her. And so this reminded me a great deal of my time in the Marine Corps, because there is death and destruction.
Yep.
There is the feasting that you can do, but then there's a whole lot of not sex in warfare. And so you're amongst this kind of very abstinent cadre of people. And so you revel in different ways. You revel in alcohol, you revel in food, and you revel in these things. And then the idea of, you know, when Macbeth murders Duncan, he's starting to hallucinate already. Methought I heard a voice, sleep no more.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, I'm reading this, you know, the first time, and you know, I come back to Macbeth again and again and again. And I just, it's how does Shakespeare know about the sleep? Because, you know, I had PTSD when I got back from Iraq in 2005, and it was, alcohol was a huge part of my quote unquote recovery, or at least what I was trying to treat myself with. And sleep was the thing that was missing, and the thing that was most hard to come by. And so I just, you know, I always just kind of wonder, like, how does Shakespeare know this stuff, is a question I always ask myself.
The reason I believe he knew, and by the way, I believe there's a veteran in every single play. I've gone through and found out that obviously in quite a few, there's a lot of them. But then when you get into, for example, As You Like It, who is it? And I started wondering that as I looking textually on my experience, who might be a veteran. But how he knew this. If we look at historically what England was going through, I would argue that they're very similar to America today. And especially when you were in the service, when we were still in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Similarly, in 1588, there was a Spanish Armada. So the UK or England and Spain were in a conventional war. Before that, they're in this on-again, off-again Cold War state, or the full-time Cold War, on-again, off-again conventional war. In 1599, when Shakespeare's writing Hamlet, finishing Henry V, as well as As You Like It and Julius Caesar, in that year, Shapiro talks about in his book 1599, about how they were preparing for a second armada, and that there were already soldiers going back and forth to Ireland. So Ireland's this guerrilla war, much like Vietnam and Afghanistan, or the latter part of Afghanistan. And then a conventional hot war, and then sometimes cold war, like we, well, apparently have right now with Russia, but also with, you know, Iraq and in World War II. So Shakespeare's in England when they're having two wars that are ongoing, on and on again. And who's fighting it? But the working class. Because Shapiro talks about in 1599, when they're getting ready for a second armada, who's going and filling the ships, and who's going down to the harbor, and who's going into the forts? It's the tradesmen. It's the blacksmiths and all these folks, the working class, just like today. He's therefore surrounded by veterans, and that's why he's able to write, just, I didn't want to jump plays on you, but I'm going to, in Henry IV, in Henry IV, Part 1, he writes Lady Percy, who asks questions of her husband, Hotspur, who is his nickname, who is a combat veteran, literally just returned home from combat, unbeknownst to his wife, is deploying the very next morning to go back to war, and she asks him a series of questions. Why do you startle so often? Why do you sit alone? Why are you depressed? Why do you curse? Why can't you eat? Why don't we have sex? Why don't you have pleasure? In her questions, she lists all the symptoms out of the diagnostic manual for post-traumatic stress disorder. He wrote this 400 plus years ago, describing exactly what we took us 400 years to put a label on it. And I think it's because he's surrounded by veterans.
That makes a lot of sense. And it also makes sense in terms of what you mentioned with the ACE test, that the trauma isn't limited to just veterans, it's nearly impossible to go through life without suffering some degree. Like, it's nearly impossible to take that ACE test and not score on it in some way. So it's not surprising that this idea of rhythm and breath and community, which is what you get when you're watching theater as well as when you're acting in theater, would resonate so much with the audience.
That's right. And he knew this then, right? They played in the globe. It's in a circle. So that resonating body is going out in all directions, three-dimensionally. So that, therefore, in that globe, it's hitting the people. We knew that it was in the middle of the day and there's no roof, so the actors could see the audience. So they're not only hearing each other, but they're seeing each other. They're reverberating and resonating with each other. And now we have studies that show exactly what you just described, that we actually, our hearts get in rhythm together, our breaths get in rhythm together. And so he put that right on stage, and there's specific plays where they come out, right? In both Henry V and Romeo and Juliet specifically, someone comes out to get us in that rhythm and to ask us to let your imagination take you around and bounce around, fill in the blanks with your imagination, but let's breathe together, get in this rhythm, and remember that it's a play. And I think that's why he did that in Henry V, to be honest. I think he has the chorus, this is my personal opinion, but I think he has the chorus to bring us back, because they were in the middle of war. The audience, and many people, just like the Greeks in the audience, would have been to war, or are family members of people who've been to war. So this is a war play being put on stage. And unlike so many of them, I mean, the wars happen off stage, but there's combat in the midst of it. You know, the famous speech, "Once more under the breach, dear friends," that's right in the middle of battle. And he put that on stage, and Henry's summoning the audience to follow him. So, you know, we did a show called Fit for Society. And in there, the drill sergeant was the narrator, because what's great about, for the military personnel, we all recognize the drill sergeant or drill instructor, depending what branch you're in. We all had them. But even civilians recognize that. That's like the one symbol that we can cross that veteran-civilian divide really easily. And they even know what they're like. So our drill sergeant would go into the audience and give the actual speech that I remember receiving on the bus. So he's, you know, and he's yelling, "So when I say move, get your fucking toes on the fucking yellow line, move, move, move." And every single night, more than one veteran would get up out of their chair, just muscle memory immediately. So I believe part of, in Henry V, part of that narrator, for me anyways, is that it helps me remember, oh, it's a play. I'm not right now deployed. Because that's what trauma does to us, right? It hijacks our sense of time and place and puts us right back in the event that we were going through or the environment that we were in. And so Shakespeare is saying, okay, breathe with me, which we now call mindfulness, right? Be in your body, which we know is necessary to not only heal from trauma, but to recover from in the immediacy, to get back in our bodies. Be here. And now we'll go to France. So that's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
I like that opinion, and I think it's sound. You've mentioned the idea of the circle a couple times, and this reminds me of how we do things at St. John's. When I got off of active duty, I went to Naval Academy Annapolis, and then we would have to march to football games. It was the biggest waste of time. To this day, I basically can't watch sports because, like, It was mandatory to do that. Yeah. And I had to wake up at 7 o'clock on a Saturday to practice marching to the football field. Oh, and it's just, I'm done. I've never been to a Naval Academy football game since I graduated. But we would walk by St. John's just as the route to the football stadium. And I remember as a plebe walking by and just seeing like a bunch of hippie kids playing hacky sack on, you know, the front lawn of this beautiful picturesque campus and just kind of like going, hey, what's going on over there? And they're like, oh, it's a bunch of hippie kids. They just read like Shakespeare and talk about it. And I'm like, I'm at the wrong place.
I'm in.
That sounds wonderful. So I went to Iraq in 05. I'd gone to Bosnia and East Africa and had not gotten to go to Iraq or Afghanistan and thought that this was ridiculous. Like, I'm a Marine officer in time of war. I need to go. So demanded to go, even though I had another opportunity to kind of go to some sexy, I was a counterintelligence officer in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
And you know, just raise your hand and they're like, okay, you go. But you know, I went to Iraq and just had this very profound kind of experience of getting shot at and of talking. Cause like mostly what a counterintelligence agent does is talk to people. So, you know, I'm just bebopping around talking to Iraqis and, you know, kind of dawned on me at some point during that tour that I was just like, I don't know if this is entirely on the up and up. And just the idea of going to Iraq and the idea of being there and the idea of participating in it. And so I had some questions and I didn't know where to go for answers. And so I had read about St. John's and heard about St. John's and been exploring St. John's. It had always been a fascination of mine. And then I decided to get off active duty just to go to St. John's. And a fascinating thing about St. John's is that we sit in a circle. And the professors are not called professors. They're called tutors because they're not there to profess at you. They're there to help you learn. And basically what happens is the tutor will ask, you'll have a reading and the tutor will ask an opening question. And the idea is just to pass that question around. And sometimes you'll have an hour and a half class where the tutor says one question and doesn't say a word the rest of the time and just allows that conversation to flow around the table. And then, so that coming from the Marine Corps, is slightly different. And, you know, something that strikes me in a lot of the plays and the history plays, certainly in Macbeth and Richard III, is the idea of hierarchy and how strange that is. And right now, so I have my podcast, I mentioned Combat and Classics, and we're doing a slow read of the Iliad right now, where we just go one book at a time. And the Iliad for me has always been a little bit of a meditation on hierarchy. It's who should be in charge of the Greek army. Should it be Agamemnon? Should it be Achilles? Should it be Odysseus? We see Shakespeare taking this idea up in Troilus and Cressida, which is weirdly one of my other favorite plays, probably just because it's, you know, a little Iliad fan fiction, but also just because Thersites is there and he's talking smack everybody. Yeah. I wonder if you've explored that idea of hierarchy and if that's any part of the decrew process, is not having anybody in charge, because I think that was something difficult for me to adapt to when I got out, was I don't have somebody in charge anymore.
Yeah, it is. You're asking such great questions. It's pulling me two directions. So I'm going to attempt to do one, then the other. The first I'll apply to Mackers. Yeah, because this is one of the things straining Macbeth and his decision to murder Duncan, right, is the hierarchy, which we recognize, you know, to murder to get that job is that, you know, even though he, you know, textually we veterans have gotten in the room and we've debated it. And veterans who've never read Shakespeare before right away are like very early going, wait a minute, did the bloody sergeant get wounded rescuing Malcolm? Yes. Is Malcolm the king's son? Yes. And he makes him next in command? Yes. Oh, yeah, bullshit, man, right? They get it. There's a psychiatrist by the name of Jonathan Shea who worked with Vietnam veterans. So he, you know, he coined that phrase, moral injury. And it resonated with me when you said that about Iraq, when you said, you know, got there and wondering what the hell. Same thing with Vietnam veterans, those of us who are from the School of the Americas era, that whole thing as well. So then to come back, that is Jonathan Shea, you know, and I've spoken to him about this. He's absolutely, that's a version of a moral injury to do that. And the same thing with McBee. He should be next in line. And in front of everyone, after he saved the day, Duncan says, yeah, no, we'll come to your house for dinner, but my son's next in command. And clearly Banquo is my second, my third favorite, so later. So that's a moral injury. And that is moral injury preconditioned to a berserker, which is how we are able to overcome our natural human instincts. The berserker allows us to do things that our humanity get in the way of. So that moral injury plays a much bigger role than one would think. And it even goes somewhat ties in, but the second area I was going to talk, you were going to talk about with hierarchy, is that hierarchy also has a role in childhood trauma or adverse childhood experiences. So what we know about trauma, in particular Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, he talks about these environments as childhood help create our lens through which we're viewing the world. And if our childhood is high in that ACE score realm, in that, dare I say, trauma realm, we're viewing the world through trauma lenses. So that hierarchy is skewed, and the military hierarchy is so present, but it supposedly makes sense. Right? We agree. It's a bunch of agreements, really, which is more control and more, even more, I don't want to say control, but more autonomy, arguably, than we even has had as a child, because we had no say in what that hierarchy is. In the military, at least I'm agreeing, yep, that person's in charge, we all follow, but I'm in charge of those two, right? So this hierarchy helps, except for when it breaks down and causes more moral injury. And then on top of it, when we get out of the military, which you already said, then, like Richard III, who the hell are we? I don't have the military hierarchy, which helped me also, by the way, for me specifically in the military. It took this kid who had such a deep self-loathing from, you know, trigger warning, I'm going to mention some childhood experiences without any detail, that I was I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. So as an adult, I carried that, and part of what's just awful about trauma, the many things, but the one of the worst, I think, is shame and the self-blame. I carried that forward, but guess what? I get in the military, they take away my clothes, I wear a uniform, so I'm no longer a survivor of trauma, I'm a wannabe soldier. Then I survive, I survive and graduate basic training, I now know this world, and I made it through the cutting process. They taught me how to walk, how to talk, how to stand, how to salute, all these things. There's no reason to loathe myself because I'm no longer that person. And in fact, I just share this very often, that since I assume I can use the actual language, but honestly, I joined the Army because that self-loathing made me feel like I was a piece of shit. So in the first 2 weeks, which interestingly they call Hell Week, the first 2 weeks, they called me a piece of shit. And I thought, oh, wow, I'm home. They get me. This is where I belong. But then they broke me down and built me back up as something else. So now I leave it, and I don't have a hierarchy. I don't have that structure, that support. And I also don't want to go back to the childhood stuff. And this is where, and now you compound that with moral injury, this is where our process, our undoing very often happens. This is why we veterans have higher suicide rates, higher addiction rates, higher homelessness rates, higher, harsher, longer prison sentences, and on and on and on. And until we do something to unwire both of those experiences, the military and that. I got a little on a rant there, but I can't help myself.
No, not a rant. I think it's a very thoughtful analysis of the type of stresses that we experience in the military. And I'm also glad that you're encouraging me to send Jenny Stewart, who's the associate artistic director at Shakespeare Dallas, some show notes with our shared recommended reading, because Shea's Odysseus in America and Achilles in Vietnam, Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps Score. These are just wonderful books that, whether you're a veteran or not, I think are just phenomenal in understanding humanity. You mentioned boot camp, and I've been spending some time thinking about that, you know, recently. And it's interesting to me that, you know, the thing that you are being kind of, I don't even want to say taught, conditioned to, is to not show any trauma, to not show any emotional response, to take any emotional response that you have while being traumatized, because that is basically what any type of boot camp is putting you through trauma and a collective type of trauma, and saying, stand up straight, look straight ahead, and only speak what we tell you to speak, you know, and only speak when you're spoken to. And I wonder how much of that ingrained response to trauma carries us over when we get out, because we can't talk about it. Stand up straight, act like there's nothing going on, act like there's nothing bother you. And again, it should be on the list twice, and don't talk about it.
It's true.
Yeah. And so I'm just wondering how much, you know, you've seen in Decruit and in working with veterans, in them kind of starting to explore the idea of talking about it, and or is just speaking the lines of Shakespeare, do you think, a way for them to talk about it, or at least begin to express some of those emotions, even if they're written down by Shakespeare and said by somebody else?
I think it's absolutely key that to speak about it. And I don't mean in the sense of just telling the same story over and over and over again. I'm talking about truly testifying, you know, or as Shakespeare puts it, to speak what we feel and not what we ought to say, to a group that can receive it. And that's, there's the actor audience experience, as Tina Packer talks about at Shakespeare and Company, right? The testifying and being witnessed and them communalizing that afterwards. It's, you know, or again, Shake, communalizing the trauma, having it be right in the room is absolutely key. It's not the only step, though. That's the thing. We get caught in this that just telling the story is gonna, I said it, and now I should be over it. I should be better. And it's not enough. For us in Decruit, what we're constantly doing is trying to turn on that self-observation without judgment, right? Can I observe how I'm breathing? So everything you said is, you know, about the voice and the body and all that. So that, and you're very astute that the trauma carries that over. Bear with me as I bounce all over with my ADHD. In Decruit, we call it reclaiming our toddler selves, right? Because we give the example of the ideal toddler. By ideal, I mean a toddler that's not having a high A score at home. But if we look at toddlers, generally, their mouth breathing, their lips are part of the jaws hanging free, their eyes are wide, they're receiving the world. They're not judging it, they're receiving it. The breath is flowing in and out, so the belly's hanging out. The skeleton is holding them upright, and the muscles are doing the bare minimum to hold them upright, and yet in alignment, because it's a pretty well-designed body, so it stays efficient, the head's bouncing on top of the spine, and the arms are floppy, except for when they don't need to be. But what happens is, whether it's social engineering, right, use your inside voice, you don't bother me right now, or actual punishments that change the way we behave, or an alcoholic parent that makes us want to be invisible, perhaps, or we freeze our breath when we're being punished, or we maybe regulate the other way, and there's so much emotion. So all of these things carry over. We're literally being formed as a child as to how we're going to deal with the world. Now, taking the military out of it for a moment, once we go through all of that, that becomes then the pattern on how we breathe, how we sound, how our body is held. The great thing about doing Shakespeare, and in particular the classics, is it forces us to ground, breathe, and take up time and space, which is not something a survivor of childhood trauma or adult trauma wants to do. We want to go back to whatever's our comfort zone, either shifting focus or blustering or whatever it is our usual track of survival, is what we tend to want to default to. But the military, again, interrupts that and picks their own version. But I'm not talking for destruction. I'm talking for creativity or healing, which for me are the same thing. In theater, then, what happens is we have to ground, breathe, and speak this language in a rhythm that gives me a way to self-regulate. So it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Da 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 da. And it turns out that helps keep the limbic system from being hijacked and going into fight, flight, freeze, fawn, or other. Also, grounding and breathing and making eye contact with the audience helps keep us in the room, which, right, interrupts and it goes against trauma. And then finally, when you're talking about the breath and the sound and Shakespeare's verse, yes, he's providing language that we might lack for ourselves, because I don't know about you, but growing up, we didn't talk about our feelings, nor did we in the military, so I don't even have the language. But let's say I did. Let's say I grew up in a family that did and gave me the language to do so. What we know about trauma, again, Bessel's book, is when we're reactivated, whether it's standing in front of an audience or in the middle of a firefight or preparing to jump out of the aircraft, whatever it is, that will try to hijack our experience. The brain, when it retreats from that trauma, the Broca's area actually with the language making center is actually offline. So even if I had the language, I can't find it. That's where Shakespeare comes in. He's providing the language and therefore also turning on that part of the brain, turning the higher part of the brain back on. And he's in that rhythm, like I mentioned, and then it's poetry. So that gives it that extra oomph. It not only allows us to really share in a way that's not, shall we say, casual, because it's not a casual experience we're talking about, nor does it feel casual. So he gives us permission to speak in that poetry. And then on top of it, he writes so brilliantly that he forces vibrations in the body that we may be trying to hold still because of that childhood trauma or that adult trauma. We may be trying to hold our jaw clenched tight and our chest tight. But if I have to say, oh, just that mere word requires me to breathe in, speak, and open the mouth into that oh, and next thing I know, it's causing emotions in me. It may even be causing or eliciting emotions in the listener as well, the witness. But the big thing is for me to unleash that trauma, to give it vibrations, to give it language so that it can be released and then purged. And finally, the final bit about that is by practicing, like anything, the more we do that, the more we observe ourselves without judgment, the more we ground and breathe, the more we allow ourselves to be in the present moment instead of being hijacked, the more we allow the body to vibrate, the more we let the poetry be our language, the more we can use that offstage as well to recover from when we get hijacked, to even perhaps be preventative before we go into a potentially tense situation, whether it's a family member that triggers us or something else. This grounding and breathing and expressing can also be preventative.
I think that is a great point to end on, because we could do about three more parts of this, but I feel like you put such a good kind of bow on it. And I mean, it's hard to put a bow on the human experience and the emotional experience that comes along with being human and coming to grips with trauma. But Stefan, thank you so much.
And they'd all be different bows.
They'd all be different bows. Trauma. Yeah. We're all a little bit different. So Stefan, how can people find out more about you and about Decruit?
Oh, thank you for doing that. www.decruit.org. It's a Decruit like recruit, but with a D, D-E-C-R-U-I-T. And it is .org because I like saying there's a kid in Kansas that owns .com and he's trying to make us bid for it. So we'll have a fundraiser for it so we can get the com back.
Well, yeah, if you do set up a GoFundMe, we'll have you back on the pod and we'll do another one and push that out. But thank you so much for joining Shakespeare Decoded.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for the work that you do. And listener, please check out Stefan's work at decruit.org.
Thank you for listening to Shakespeare Decoded, presented by Shakespeare Dallas. For more information about Shakespeare Dallas, visit shakespeare-dallas.org.